come up on a tight wire.
My name's Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. My guest today is poet Emma Treyes, winner of the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize and author of Tropicalia, which is a fantastic book of poems. She's going to join us. And on Poetic License, we have Raul Sanchez, who's going to talk about his poetry and maybe even read a poem. He's a fantastic poet, so stick around. This morning on my run through the neighborhood where I live, I noticed there were a lot of pumpkins. There were pumpkins in windows, pumpkins next to trees. There was one stone fence where there was just a line of pumpkins, and they were carved into jack-o'-lanterns. And I started to recall what Richard Blanco wrote in his memoir when he tried to feed pumpkin pie to his family for Thanksgiving because he wanted an American Thanksgiving, but they refused to eat it because who wants to eat foot? Because the word pie in Spanish is pie. And worse than that, why would they want to eat foot of squash? Because calabaza is how you say pumpkin in Spanish, which also means any kind of squash. So you can fry up some squash. Who wants to eat squash pie? Who would want to go to Starbucks and order a spiced squash latte? It sounds disgusting. And so this got me to thinking of mistranslations, how when we try to translate stuff from one language to another, we oftentimes encounter weird errors. Like I was in China recently. I was in Beijing. I was doing a reading at one of the universities over there. And on one of my days off, I started walking around and I went into this bar and I ordered a glass of wine and I'm sitting there and there's nobody there. And suddenly I have to go to the bathroom. I get up and go to the bathroom, and there's a sign on the door, and it says, no bowels allowed. Yeah, no bowels allowed. Okay, so what, I have to get an operation before I use this bathroom? And I know exactly what it means. It's basically saying they don't want you to go number two in their bathroom. I don't know why they don't just do like they do in Juarez and remove the toilet seat and make sure there's no hot water, but that's clearly a mistranslation. And then in a food market in China, and China is full of these mistranslations, there was in the vegetable section a big sign that said, don't touch yourself. What's the point? It's like Woody Allen says, it's sex with someone I love. And then one time when I was in Cuba, and this is a true story, there are these old ladies that sometimes guard the bathrooms on stools. They, for a little, you know, money, they'll let you in the bathroom. If you give them a little more, they'll give you soap, and a little more, they'll give you toilet paper. I wanted soap. I wanted the whole full VIP package, so I asked for soap. But soap in Spanish is jabón. But I accidentally says, señora, ¿tiene jamón? I asked her if she had ham. And then, this is also a true story, at a market in Barcelona, one of those really beautiful food markets, this tourist, who was obviously staying in the city, goes up to the butcher and she says, quiero ternura. And the butcher just kind of looks at her and gives her a hug. She was saying, I want affection. What she meant was, I want ternera, which is veal. Another mistranslation. And then I found this online, a menu in a city in Mexico. One of the items was well-hung meat. Yeah, it sounds like a dish made exactly for me. I teach in the MFA program, as you know, and I had a Swedish student one time, and she was writing a story about a young woman on a horse with a bunch of other people, and she had a confession to make with all her friends. So the line she wrote was, and so I sat on the horse and I exposed myself. Yeah, I don't think that's really what she wanted to say. But let's not forget one of the most famous mistranslations when Jimmy Carter spoke to the Polish people. He meant to say, I want to know the desires of the Polish people. But instead he said, I want to know you carnally, your sexual perversions. Oh yeah, maybe he was just foreshadowing the energy of the Bill Clinton administration. But mistranslations can be, well, they can be troublesome, they can be humorous, but don't mistranslate me. This is going to be an awesome show. Join us, Emma Treyes, the poet, is going to be on Words on a Wire. Emma Treyes is author of the chapbook Little Spells and the full book of poems called Tropicalia, which is the winner of the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize and a finalist for the Forward Review's Indie Fab Poetry Book of the Year. She has read her work at many venues, including the Poet and the Poem series at the Library of Congress, Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C., the Miami Poetry Festival, and many, many more. Her work has appeared in Poets Artists, The Best American Poetry, Terrain.org, and she is poetry editor of Mi Poesias magazine. Emma, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hi, Daniel Chacon. Thanks for having me.
You won the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize with your fantastic book, Tropicalia. Where is that word come from?
You know, it's actually a word that I appropriated
nice.
From a Brazilian movement.
I.e., you stole it.
Yeah, okay, I stole it. All right.
Good writers borrow, great writers steal.
Okay. I'll go with that. It's also called tropicalismo, and it was sort of a mashup of art genres, theater, literature, visual art, but primarily music. In the 1960s in Brazil, and the music was sort of spearheaded by Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil, and they sort of fused together rock music, you know, as we kind of understood it at that time, with traditional Brazilian and Afro rhythms, and it was also very political. So, you know, when I thought about it, it was, to me, it sort of represented this idea of pushing together a lot of different aspects of culture, sort of like a cultural conflation. And so it came to me that I was kind of trying to do the same thing with my book. I was trying to sort of, you know, address some politics, some of the natural world, some of what it is to be a daughter of immigrants. And then, of course, the whole book was written where I lived almost my entire life until very recently, which is South Florida, and that is the tropics, you know.
Right.
And it got such a fertile, you know, humid kind of city meets nature struggle to it. So I just, one day, it just sort of popped into my head. I'm like, that's it.
So your first book is called Tropicalia, and it is a book of poems that won the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. I just had this great idea. When the posthumous book of poems comes out by Andres Montoya, the one I've been editing, we should have a big celebration and invite all the winners of the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize to read a poem from the book. Wouldn't that be awesome?
That would be so amazing. I mean, I feel really indebted to Andres Montoya. I know you were a good friend of his as well, so we've all kind of been excited that you're editing this book and looking forward to it. May I ask if you have an estimated time of publication, an ETP?
Well, according to the contract that I signed, it's supposed to be out 6 months ago. But
yeah.
There has been a delay, so we're hoping it'll be out by the fall. But
yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading that.
Oh, it's going to be awesome. But back to Tropicalia, tell us how this book came about. This is your first book of poems, am I right?
Well, I had a smaller chapbook of poems put out by Goth 183, which is a micro press in Bloomington, Illinois, run by Didi Menendez, who's just like this amazing publisher who not only publishes chapbooks and books, but she publishes poets and artists and Mi Poesias and Ocho and these incredibly gorgeous publications. But yeah, she put out a little chapbook of mine in 2008, and then this was my first full-length collection.
You went to, from what I understand, MFA at Florida International. Did this start in grad school?
It did, Daniel. It started in grad school. You know, I obviously had a thesis, like everyone, which, you know, I've often commented saying that I want to sneak into the library at Florida International and set it on fire. You know, I hate thinking that it's out there. You know, it's embarrassing.
Oh, wow.
But,
that's great.
I basically took my thesis and just worked on just intense revisions. And then, of course, you know, the new poems that I had been slowly writing along the way. You know, when I finished grad school, I didn't go into academia. I was kind of burnt out with that at the time. And I just fell into journalism. So I was a working journalist, a full-time working journalist, for many years. So I just kind of eking the poems out on the side.
Mm.
You know, it was a pretty consuming job. So wasn't like I was writing a lot, but I was able to develop, you know, about half the book, I would say, is all new work post-grad school.
Wow. And with a full-time job, when did you write? Did you write in the mornings,
yeah,
in the evenings, afternoons?
I've never been a person of routine with writing. I wish I was. You know, I'm just not that disciplined, I suppose, or maybe my mind just doesn't work that way. It was just, you know, whenever I would just always be taking notes, you know, in my notebook. I always had a notebook. I had my notebooks for work, but I also had my own creative books. And, you know, I was just always scratching down notes. Sometimes I would write notes right in my reporter's pad. And, in fact, one of the poems in the book is called Reporter's Notebook, and I actually wrote it beside the notes I was taking for a story. At, you know, at the same time, I was just toggling back and forth between the two, and that turned into that poem. And it's funny because that poem is even shaped in the long rectangular shape of a reporter's notebook that you get at any daily or weekly newspaper.
Oh, nice. You know, one of the challenging things of writing poetry is how we can often let our poetic voice, you know, the voice that we use in poetry, the way we express ourselves in poetry when we write prose, and oftentimes it's a little bit excessive. Did you ever have any problem where you turned in a story for your journalist job that was just a little too poetic?
You know, a little bit, not that much, though, because I started out as a news reporter at an alt-weekly in Fort Lauderdale called New Times. I was hired as a paid fellow, and then they picked me up on staff. It's part of the Village Voice media chain now. But, you know, a little bit then, but it was actually kind of valued by my editor at the time. He was kind of like an old school Irish editor named Tom Walsh, really gruff guy that treated me with a lot of respect and taught me a lot. And so he was sort of happy to have someone that could put a sentence together, maybe in a little our lyrical way.
Uh-huh.
That was just my personal experience. And then after that, I went ahead and shifted gears and just strictly wrote about arts and culture. So that kind of writing is really valued in arts and culture and entertainment writing. So I was pretty lucky that I sort of slid into that, and it matched the way I was writing.
I'm talking to Emma Treyes, author of Tropicalia, one of the winners of the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. You worked in journalism. You were in the Miami area, and because you went to grad school there, or were you from there?
I was from there, just born and raised, and you know, that's the grad school that I wanted to go to, and also that I could best afford. And they had an amazing faculty. And
Denise DeHommel.
She wasn't there.
Oh,
at
she
the
wasn't.
Time
oh.
When I was there.
She also blurbed your book. Gave you a really nice blurb.
Yeah. I was lucky enough that she blurred my book. She came on board like a few years after I had graduated. I studied primarily with Campbell McGrath.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a lot of visiting poets like Jim Daniels and Maxine Kuman, and Lee Young Lee came and spoke to us, and just a lot of different people like that sort of came in and complimented our everyday curriculum.
Well, you have just mentioned two of my poetry heroes, Denise DeHommel. I just love her work. Had her on the show twice.
Oh, she's amazing.
And
she's an amazing person, too.
Yeah.
Just so talented as a poet, and then just such an authentic person.
Yeah.
I love talking to her and then working with her in any capacity.
Yeah, and Lee Young Lee, of course, is you know, one of the greatest poets we have today.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, he's just the voice of the ages.
So now you're in Santa Barbara, is that correct?
I am.
And what are you doing there?
You know, if somebody would have told me that I wind up living in California, I would have laughed because it was just so far away. And also, I never liked the idea of living in a place where the earth could sort of just open up and swallow you unexpectedly. But it's very beautiful here. We moved here. My husband got a job here, so we moved. He moved here first, and we did a bi-coastal for a while last year. And then I moved out here full-time in November. No, the funny thing is, I'm actually going back to Miami for the Miami International Book Fair. I'm going to be reading as part of a group project that partnered visual artists with poets. And so they kind of, you know, took our poems and created these, like, gorgeous broadsides. And the artist, Diane Arrieta, she does a collective called Birds Are Nice.
Mm-hmm.
She made this, like, amazing broadside of one of my new poems from my new book that I'm working on. And so I'm going to be going down there and reading it, you know, along with a bunch of other poets, and hopefully meet the artists in person and say thank you and buy a bunch of books that I don't have any room for.
Yeah, right. AWP, it's hard to walk through the book fair.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, it's deadly. It's a deadly
habit. You have to bring an empty suitcase.
Yes, that's a good idea. Maybe I'll try that next time.
So, Emma, tell us about your new work.
Well, I would say I started writing it even at the end of Tropicale. I can see a few of the poems in that book already transitioning into some of the themes and style that I'm writing in now. But I have a tentative title, which of course might change, but
absolutely,
at the moment it's called Courage and the Clock. It's a line adapted from a phrase in Gertrude Stein's Tender Buttons, and I'm kind of a lot more interested in moving away from narrative poetry and sort of trying to be a little more experimental with meditation and the lyric and form. So we'll see how that turns out.
Do you think that that is a kind of organic move for a poet to take, that maybe we start off very narrative, but then we start to give in more to lyricism, give in more to language?
That's a good question. I think it's different for everyone. I think perhaps people that, maybe there are people that start off, in the outer bands of experimental sorts of forms and approaches and stay there. Or maybe they move backwards towards or peripherally towards narrative. But for me, I just felt like I wanted to find a way to talk about the world that wasn't so overtly autobiographical. And I feel that all writing is autobiographical.
Right. Like Borges says, we hide in the subtextual corners of our work.
Yes, definitely. I think that's very true. And I think with this collection of poems, I'm more interested in looking outward. But, of course, the inward is there as well. It's something I've been thinking a lot about. Just take the me so much out of the subject and think more about a poetry of witness, which kind of goes along with the idea that I've always had of poetry as a document, as a way of preservation. So I'm sort of exploring all of that right now.
One of the things that I'm learning as I'm writing my first book of poems is when I first started to write poems, I think I wanted the reader to understand the poem. And I think I put so much emphasis on the reader to understanding the poem that not only were my poems really heavily narrative, but I think they also became heavily prosaic. And at a certain point, I realized that it's about the sound and it's about the music. And even if the reader doesn't get, quote, the meaning of the poem, they're going to get the music and the images are going to pop out at them. And that's enough. That's enough, the first reading of a poem.
The feel of it is just as important as to, quote, unquote, understanding. And I think Billy Collins was a great poem about workshopping.
Introduction to Poetry. Yes, it's a great poem.
Yeah, and they're tying the poem to a chair and, whipping the truth out of it.
Yeah.
And use the kind of the image that he uses. But I don't think it's necessarily that important to get, quote, unquote, every line or every reference that a poet is making. A lot of it is just sometimes a visceral response, or
right,
just an atmosphere. Or like you said, the sound, the music of the poem that stays with you like a song. Yeah, I think that's really interesting to kind of figure out a way to balance those two. I want my readers to be able to enter my poem. I do want to have a certain, a small doorway of accessibility. But at the same time, it's not journalism. I don't have to put down the who, what, why, and where.
Right, and we should be able to enter the poem the same way we enter a Bach fugue. When we enter into a fugue, we're experiencing it. And images are going to pop up in our minds. And they say that a lot of philosophers say that music is the highest form of art. For that reason, we don't need a text. We don't need an understanding. We just need an experience. And I think poetry, the best poetry, works the same way. We enter into it, an experience, as opposed to put A and B together and say, oh, this is the meaning of it, tying it to a chair, like you were saying.
Yes, but, kind of like what Emily Dickinson, I think it was Emily Dickinson, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. and I like that idea. That's been kind of a governing force in these new poems that I've been writing.
Well, I can't wait to hear one. We want you to read a poem. You could read one from Tropicália, but if you want to read one of your new ones, that would be great, too. Do you have any idea what you'd like to read?
All right, I'm going to go ahead and read a new poem. I actually wrote it, and it was published earlier this year in Poets Artists, and I was really honored because the magazine nominated it for a pushcart.
Nice.
So thank you, Didi Menendez and Poets Artists. But yeah, it kind of has some California in it, which is pretty interesting, watching how the landscape and the drought and that kind of thing is sort of creeping its way into my work. I think I'm very much a poet of place, you know, whether I'm writing in narrative or lyric form, and that's making its way into here, you know, as well as, you know, myth, which I'm completely obsessed with, and sort of the idea of deception and how we endure it. And so this poem is called Hoodwinked. The language of branches buried in the sun's pulse. Only the dead can decipher it. Sky coiled and the needle of crows. The hedges detonating flowers whose names you don't know. Why we drive so willingly into the haze. Why the meek eat alone. Each day another stone laid. Along this maze lined with dust and flammable vines. There is no rain, and how can you trust a place without water, without a bank to bend and drink? Each night you pray for his demise and hope to know when her head cracks the pavement. It feels good to say it here where no one will see, no ball of thread to guide you home. The corridor ends at a cave you will live in for however long it takes. Fur and horns and the truth's eyes upon you. Of course, you will tremble. You will fight. Why, you will never know why.
That was Emma Treyes, author of Tropicália. Emma, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hello, everyone. My name is Raul Sanchez, and I live here in Seattle, Washington. In 2012, I got my very first collection of poetry published by Moonpath Press, and the editor is a friend of mine also. Over the years, she kept telling me, Raul, you need a book. Raul, you need a book. And then she got tired of saying that. She says, give me what you have, I would like to publish you. So I guess I was I got a little lucky in that sense. I didn't have to struggle too much trying to get published. Once I gave her a big three-ring binder of the poems that I had up to that time, she suggested a title, which is all Brown Skin Angels, or it wasn't quite defined. Then I said, no, I don't like the angel idea. And then she said, listen, write this into the poem, or make it as a title of the poem. So I got to work on that, and I sent her five poems, and she picked two of them, and they're in the book. Last year, this book got nominated for the Washington Book Award in Poetry. I was competing against some very heavy hitters, so obviously I didn't make it, but at least it was nominated, so I had the pride to put that on my resume. I have been reading from the book from Bellingham all the way to Vancouver. When books are published by small presses, sometimes it's a little difficult to promote simply because we don't have an agent. It's just ourselves and the people that know us, and that's how we connect between the people and the audience. And as far as connections have been, I get to meet a lot of good people that keep inviting me to do readings. And, of course, I read from the book and I read some new work. And this year, particularly, I was accepted into the Jack Straw Writers Program here in Seattle, where we learn presentation, voice coaching, and we had to present a piece of work that we were going to be working through the year. And my submission was a memoir in free verse, and I'm still working on it. The original manuscript keeps getting bigger and bigger because I keep adding post-it notes of things I remember from my youth or later, in my early adulthood that I don't want to forget. One time I did ask Sandra Cisneros what is the best way to write a memoir, and she says, just whatever comes to mind, write it down. Don't worry about the chronology. Just put it all together, and then you can sort them out, put them in the right order. I would like to share with you the poem, All Our Brown Skin Angels, which is the same title of the book. This poem has been used by the Dreamer Team group out in Yakima, who most of the members go to the Yakima Community College, and every time they go to an immigration rally, they begin with that particular poem. And I had no idea about this when I found out about it. I just felt very, very humble and honored that these kids have been using my book for the rallies. So I feel that somehow my book has reached some people that have no idea where they are, and little by little they keep manifesting. I said in the past that if our words, written or spoken, can make a change, that's precisely what our poems should do for people, especially young people in general, especially people like us, immigrants that come from somewhere else, and those who are feel oppressed by immigration laws and other laws that are impeding the progress. No human being has the right to deprive others from their freedom. But we live amongst people who carry stones instead of hearts. Hatred on their tongues. These descendants of colonizers' racist agenda is always to get rid of those that don't fit their way of being. Fear and threats are their weapons. Laws such as HB 56 and SB 1070 imposed by judges and rulers to carry out ethnic cleansing, to eradicate from our soil all our brown skin angels. All our brown skin angels. Our skin is not dirty. Our language is not obscene. We are not garbage. The sun shines the same on all people, no matter how they treat us. We will no longer run from our oppressors. We will not hide. If we must fight, we will defend ourselves by our united hearts. Our strength is in our blood, in our voice, in our history. We are warriors. Meshikatiawi. And I'm Raul Sanchez. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank my guest, Emma Treyes, for joining us on Words on a Wire. I'd also like to thank the poet, Raul Sanchez, for sharing his wonderful words with us. I'm Daniel Chacon. Join me here every week on Words on a Wire. And don't forget, the next book you read could save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubber-necked giraffe, you look into my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight.